Welcome to Writers Forum, a weekly presentation of WRBH-FM. I'm Sherry Alexander, and this week we're talking to Peggy Scott Laborde and John McGill, authors most recently of Christmas in New Orleans. Welcome to Writers Forum, folks.
Thank you very much. Tis the season.
Well, we'll start with Peggy. Peggy, we all know you around here. You're the host producer of Steppin' Out, a weekly entertainment interview program, and you've done many, many documentaries for WYES Television on New Orleans culture, background.
Well, I'm so pleased that I can sort of play an adult form of show and tell. Okay, I can learn about stuff and then show and tell our audience, and it's great fun to be able to do that. And a few years back, I did a documentary called Christmas in New Orleans, and also many years back, one called Creole Christmas. So those two were really the source of inspiration. And then my longtime friend here, John McGill, who is truly a walking encyclopedia of New Orleans-abilia, has always been interested in Christmas. And of course, just a few years back, we did the Canal Street, New Orleans Great Wide Way book together. And out of that, there was a chapter about Christmas in New Orleans on Canal Street. And our dear friends at Pelican Publishing were kind enough, and I said, do you think you might be interested in something just on Christmas? And they said yes almost immediately, and here we are.
Well, we're glad you're here. And John, you're an historian, and you're at the New Orleans Historical Collection.
Historic New Orleans Collection.
Right. And so you bring an academic kind of background to this.
Well, I've had a long interest in the evolution of Christmas from its earliest pagan roots as Saturnalia and the Feast of Mithras in ancient Rome, and how the early Catholic Church blended the two together to create the birth of Christ on the 25th of December, so as to tie in with these long favorite rather raucous holidays, but there would be no way that the Romans would have given up such holidays. It would be like people in New Orleans giving up Mardi Gras.
Well, the result is just delightful. We enjoyed talking to you when you wrote the Canal Street book, and it's real obvious. The most memorable chapter for me was the chapter about Christmas, so it's real obvious why you elaborated on that with this new book.
It was clear that there was plenty to talk about. Actually, it's 13, count them, 13 chapters. I did try to, when I was organizing it, and John and I were kind of coordinating it, I tried to make it, you know, sort of cutesy 12 days of, you know, 12 chapters of, but we had way too much stuff because there's no other book like it. I have to brag just for a moment to handle that topic, Christmas in New Orleans, the history and the celebration in such depth. There's no book on just Christmas in New Orleans. There have been chapters in other books about early Christmas, but nothing this extensive. And the other important point is that we go all the way to Twelfth Night because in New Orleans, that is the official, a start of Carnival and the end of Christmas. But way back when, and I'll let John address this, it used to be January the 8th as the end of Christmas, John.
Yeah, well, Christmas sort of, I call them parameters of Christmas, have changed over the various decades in New Orleans. Today, you know, the Christmas season begins, almost at Halloween. And for many people, it ends the day after Christmas. In some cases, it's New Year's. Others still, adhere to Twelfth Night. But historically, Christmas would begin on Christmas Eve then end on Twelfth Night. In New Orleans, though, there were some differences. If you go back to the very early 19th century, just after the Louisiana Purchase, December the 20th for a while was used as the beginning of the Christmas season because that was when Louisiana was transferred from France to the United States. And it stayed that way until we got up to the Battle of New Orleans. And then they began celebrating the beginning of the holiday season on the 23rd of December, which was when the first American troops began to arrive, and there was a skirmish between Jackson and his troops, and the British were forced to lines closer to the Mississippi River, which would lead up to the Battle of New Orleans. And then January the 8th, which was the date of the Battle of New Orleans, became the end of the holiday season in New Orleans, and that lasted until about the time of the Civil War. And then the beginning of the holiday season began to move closer to Christmas Eve, as it had done traditionally, and moved back to Twelfth Night, because by that time, the carnival season was beginning to develop more big time in New Orleans than it had previously.
Okay, well, let's start off with Canal Street, since that's the home of so many celebrations, and you describe, and many, many people who buy this book will take great pleasure in thinking about and looking at the pictures of all these great department stores that were here.
Absolutely. In the things that I do on, for Channel 12 and anything in print, I'm always interested, certainly, in I feel like I'm my own focus group. What am I interested in? And being a baby boomer who grew up in New Orleans, we remember the wonderful days of shopping on Canal Street. It was, and well, still is, but it was truly New Orleans' Main Street, and that's where the bulk of the department stores were. My mom worked for over 20 years at D.H. Holmes's, as we like to say, right there in the middle of Canal Street. And then later on in college, I worked there part-time. But I have fond memories of working there at Christmas time. And, of course, the street would be beautifully decorated. Holmes was known for its very elaborate windows. Maison Blanche, of course, was known for Mr. Bingle and the puppet show.
Tell us about Mr. Bingle. We have to talk about Mr. Bingle.
Of course, we do. You know, how unlikely in a semi-tropical climate that, you know, an icon of New Orleans Christmas. And I could truly use that word. I think icon is a word that's overused. But in this instance, I think it is correct that a little snowman would be the symbol of Christmas. But what happened was the display director at Maison Blanche, Emile Aline Jr., was the display director, and he went up to Chicago on a buying trip, and he noticed that the major department stores had these little mascots, if you will, Goodwill ambassadors. So this is in the 1940s, 1947, and so he comes down back, goes back down to New Orleans and pitches the idea of a snow doll to his bosses, and they said, well, this is a great idea, and then there's a contest to name the snow doll, and hence Mr. Bingle, MB. Okay, the initials are very, very convenient. And Mr. Bingle had his own TV show, his own puppet show, animated by Oscar Eisentrout. That's the little whiny voice of Mr. Bingle. He's a very talented puppeteer.
Can we get you two to sing the jingle?
Oh,
jingle,
well, jingle, jingle, here comes Mr. Bingle with another message from Kris Kringle.
Here to make your season jolly,
pleasing.
Typical
yes,
New Orleans.
Right. But that's a very good question. That's a very good question, actually.
Great commercial figure.
It is. But, you know, the other thing about Canal Street is that, believe it or not, New Orleans from 1930s to all the way to 1970 had its own official decorator. And her name was Betty Finnan. And one of her many duties was to decorate the wonderful light posts. The city of New Orleans.
We had an
the official city of New Orleans, and Betty Finnan. And she did many things. She planned Christmas parades. She decorated Mardi Gras. But the light posts on the, and we still say, of course, neutral ground, could be one year there might be chimneys, another year just festooned with Christmas wreaths, that kind of thing. But the street just looked great. Lots of lights. Very beautiful.
It's still a beautiful place.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And just this season, in fact, as we're taping this, just this week, we've seen the reopening of the Roosevelt Hotel, which most people who lived here their whole lives never stopped calling it the Roosevelt, although for 50 years or so it was actually had a different name. And it's back to the Roosevelt, and you have the angel hair in the lobby.
Well, it's one of the must visits as a child. Mm-hmm. You go downtown, of course, to go see the windows and homes in Maison Blanche in the decorations inside the stores, but you had to go to the lobby. And if someone has not been, because it only just recently reopened since Katrina, it is a block long. It stretches from Barone to University Place, and it will be once again decorated to its former glory. I think they said that it's going to be more of a winter wonderland this year with trees. I'm not sure if the angel hair canopy will be up or not. I don't think it will be. But it's going to be mighty pretty, and they'll have their teddy bear tees. And now, actually, since Katrina, when the Roosevelt was closed, then the Fairmont, a lot of other downtown hotels have taken up the teddy bear tea idea. And also in the quarter, too, the Royal Sonesta has one, and the Mott Leon,
and
too.
And Fulton Street has...
Now, Fulton Street, the interesting thing about that is that was inspired by the lobby, because there is a canopy that encompasses part of Fulton Street. And some folks, in case you're wondering, where is Fulton? You may remember that one of the promises of the World's Fair, of which we have very fond memories, memories of, but financially it was not the success, but aesthetically it certainly was. And the promise was that after the fair, the Fulton Street would blossom into this commercial district of restaurants and bars and stuff like that. That didn't happen until Harrah's, which had the oomph to do that. And so the street is becoming very much alive, and they do what they call Miracle on Fulton Street, Miracle on
it's
34th Street being inspired.
It's very nice.
And it snows every few
yes.
minutes, too, in the canopy.
So that's kind of glorious. John, Christmas in New Orleans a long time ago was a much more serious affair. People, you said, visited creches instead of, you know, going to department stores.
No, I really wouldn't say it was that serious. Christmas Eve in New Orleans and Christmas Day could be very raucous and very rowdy. The season began Christmas Eve for the most part in the latter part of the 19th century, and huge numbers of people would congregate on Canal Street because that was payday for most working class people, Christmas Eve. They would go shopping that day. You know, they didn't have credit cards then. They had to pay cash for what they bought, and they would just swarm into Canal Street with their kids. But there were also masses and masses of people who would go down there to see and be seen, but lots and lots of kids, but adults as well, who would beat drums, would blow horns, shoot off fireworks, and, yeah, shoot guns into the air. It was not unusual for people to be hit by falling bullets at that time, just as, you know, we occasionally hear about it today. We're much more shocked about such things today than people were in the 19th century. But, no, there were just literally tens of thousands of people on Canal Street. Midnight Mass was certainly a part of life for many people in New Orleans, especially the more pious people and those who were trying to celebrate what in the Victorian period would be the more ideal family Christmas, a Christmas of children, a Christmas that would include, and especially in the Creole families, Midnight Mass, an after Mass Réveillon, a light Réveillon afterwards.
Tell us about this Réveillon. That's special. You don't see that in many places.
Réveillon really means reawakening, and it can be a late night meal, either Christmas Eve or New Year's Eve, or it can be after the theater, you know, someone going to the French Opera in the late 19th century and then going over to the French Market for coffee. That would be a very light Réveillon. But at Christmas time, there was a special Réveillon. It was a relatively light meal. It would generally include maybe griots and grits, sweets, cakes, eggnog, which was very, very popular at that time in New Orleans. The bigger Réveillon would be New Year's Eve. That would be the time when, you know, the families with money would bring everything out and really have a grand meal. But Peggy can probably talk more about sort of the rebirth of the
yes.
Réveillon today.
Well, a little bit over 20 years ago, French Quarter Festivals, which we're so grateful for, and every April there's the French Quarter Festival, but the actual organization stages many events throughout the year, including Satchmo Fest and Christmas in New Orleans. And this was an effort to attract visitors at a fairly slow time of the year. And so there are lots of great activities, free
caroling
concerts.
In Jackson Square.
Well, that's the patio planters, which has been part of the scene actually since the late 1940s. But Christmas in New Orleans, and it would be one of the events. And Christmas in New Orleans is kind of the umbrella organization. Even the patio planters does that independently, but it's still part of the mix. They have holiday strollers. People dressed. It's the Living History Project. It's called, where people are dressed as famous figures from the city. Past and all that. But one of the things that they have done is they put together with quite a few restaurants, now over 30, Réveillon dinners, which are festive dinners around this time of the year at a good price. It's a complete meal, and they use that term Réveillon. So these days, if you'd ask somebody what's a Réveillon, for them it would be a fancy dinner at a restaurant. But indeed, most of the time, the majority of the time, it was something that was done at home many years back.
Well, it's beautiful, a beautiful custom. One of the most charming stories you tell is about the decorated homes and the Santani family.
Yes, and I think many people will still recall that at the corner of Canal and South Murat Street is this beautiful arts and crafts style home that is actually up on a terrace. It looks like something you'd see in Gentilly Terrace, the neighborhood. But the decorations were very much a part of Mrs. Myra Santani's handiwork from the mid-1940s to the 1960s. The Santani family, who owned Gold Seal, remember Creole cream cheese?
Right.
Gold Seal Dairy, which wasn't far from there in Mid-City on South Alexander Street. Mrs. Santani and Mr. Santani had seven children, and Mrs. Santani loved Christmas, and she also had this beautiful side yard that was always full of flowers. But at Christmas time, what she would do is she would hunt around for children's books relating to Christmas, and each year she would have a theme. And one of the most beautiful ones was Santa Goes to the Circus, and you had a almost life-size foil elephant, and we have photos of that. Also, there was usually an element that was added each year, and Santa's workshop with a little little elves hammering away, you know, making those toys for the kiddies would be a part of it. The other thing was a life-size nativity scene. And the costumes, the different figures were actually mannequins from department stores, downtown department stores. And the three wise men were actually wearing carnival costumes, Duke's costumes, because Mr. Santani was a member of a local carnival organization. So that was great fun. When Christmas in the Oaks, which ultimately became Celebration in the Oaks in City Park, opened, and by the, as I said, the 1960s, mid-60s, they had stopped doing it. Mrs. Santani, unfortunately, passed away on New Year's, so they stopped doing it. But the nativity scene was donated much later to the beginnings of Christmas in the Oaks.
Well, that's
in
beautiful.
City Park.
But it also inspired a young Al Copeland.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. A young boy with his family, and they didn't have much money, but they loved. And this is one of the rituals you had in New Orleans. You'd get in the car, you know, your parents would get you all bundled up, and you go and see the different decorated houses. There was the David House on St. Charles Avenue, but the Santani House was the most popular. And they'd even have to have a policeman to, you know, in terms of directing traffic. But Mr. Copeland, of course, of Popeye's Fried Chicken fame, was so impressed as a little boy by these decorations that he promised himself if he ever had the wherewithal, he would do that too. And Copeland decorated for over 30 years. And actually, when Mr. Santani died, I talked to his youngest son, Sammy, and he told me that at the funeral home, there are these, you know, beautiful floral arrangements that are arriving, and suddenly this is illuminated Christmas wreath. I thought, where did that come from? And the card said, "To the true king of Christmas," from Al Copeland. So Mr. Copeland remembered that even into his adulthood.
And until he died, he had that display.
For over 30 years, he decorated his home. And our understanding is that this year, those lights now will finally, you know, of course, he passed a few years back, but those lights were now going to be on display at Lafreniere Park in Metairie.
The music, of course, being in New Orleans, we're never far from food and music. And the Christmas music, one of my very favorite New Orleans characters is Benny Gunch.
Benny Gunch and the Bunch,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Benny is so clever. He comes up with these great lyrics, and he changes them around almost every year on the, you know, sort of the 12 days of Christmas, New Orleans style. And, of course, he's the king of Ain't There No More. So he encourages us to reminisce.
12 Yats of Christmas.
Yes.
Where he, and I think WWL-TV did a video of that.
Frank Davis,
yes.
Yes. And it's very, very clever. But he's clever. Santa Claus and the reindeer have all kinds of adventures, crazy adventures because of him. But he's a good guy, and you see him around a lot this time of the year.
We can't not mention that late unpleasantness.
The Katrina chapter.
Katrina.
Absolutely. We felt that it was just mandatory because the Katrina Christmas was certainly one that we'll all remember, especially if we're lucky enough to be back in New Orleans. And, you know, God bless the folks who decorated the outsides of their trailer
or
tree stumps, you know, and things like that at that time of the year. And really, at that point and till today, the fleur-de-lis was the symbol everybody was buying for Christmas stuff. And, you know, here we are in Magazine Street. And Magazine Street, because it was in the Sleva by the Reva, as they were calling it, didn't flood. And so this street, any stores that were able to be open, as many of them did reopen after the storm, did gangbuster business because it was among the few retail establishment strips that you could go and visit. But fleur-de-lis, any item with fleur-de-lis were particularly popular, I guess now again with the Saints.
Worldwide, yes.
Actually, to add to Magazine Street, I think it's actually become a tradition now at Christmas for people to come to Magazine Street and shop. I think it you know, as awful as Katrina was, I think it was really a great push for Magazine Street.
At that time, I remember I was back, and the Lakeside Mall always had a little Christmas display, and there was some controversy because...
We talk about that. We actually have pictures. Right. I had taken pictures of it, yes. There's typically a Santa's Village kind of thing with a different theme each year, but there's this gentleman who recreates something, and that time he had those Katrina cottages and the unfortunately ubiquitous blue roofs, as we've come to call them, and those, of course, are the blue tarps that were over the roofs that had been damaged. But I think he went rather far because he had miniature helicopters and people being rescued, and so all
and
too
with the
visual
surgical mask that we
right.
were all wearing.
But also there was reference made to the pumps that did not function because there weren't people there to make them work in Jefferson Parish, so it created a little bit of a controversy politically. And so they had removed some of the stuff that was fairly controversial, and they got so much flack. They put the stuff back, but they were very smart, the folks at Lakeside, because they even had an area where you could comment. And by and large, the comments were like, no, this is the way it was. We want this. But it was quite an amazing display.
It was a Christmas, as you said, and none of us will forget.
No.
Now, we have in the present day, we have Celebration in the Oaks, which you mentioned. And for people who aren't lucky enough to have been in New Orleans at Christmas, you drive through the park or you can walk
through
the park.
Well, yeah, these days, post-Katrina, you walk. There's the walking tour. My understanding is that the drive-through is too labor-intensive right now, but there's plenty to see, and there's always live entertainment.
Trees are decorated. There's a train that runs
through. Take the train ride. That is great fun because you do go around part of the park and through the oak trees, and the oak trees have been amazingly decorated. We've got some great photos. We have a photo of the poinsettia tree that I think is outstanding. That's in the conservatory.
And the Sugar Bowl is played. Now we're moving because we're going to go to Twelfth Night, so we have to mention the Sugar Bowl.
The Sugar Bowl really brought New Year's back to life in New Orleans. Throughout the 19th century, really from about the 1830s and 40s on to the end of the century, one of the popular things to do in this city was for people to go visiting their various friends. And, of course, people still visit on New Year's Day, but then it was virtually an obsession on New Year's Day. You know, of course, it was a very lively New Year's Eve, but then especially men would go out and visit their women friends, not necessarily girlfriends, but just, you know, women they knew. It was considered the proper thing to do. T.K. Wharton, who was the English-born architect on the Custom House, commented that he visited 20-some ladies one day, and he'd worn out his shoes, and the streets were very muddy and messy, but he was very pleased with the numbers of people he had visited. By the time you got into the early 20th century, this was beginning to die out. In fact, it had pretty well died out by World War I. Nobody was really doing that, and New Year's Day was considered just really kind of another day. You know, you had the celebration of New Year's Eve, and then New Year's Day just died away. And then for a number of years, really even before the 1930s, there were plans to have a bowl game played in New Orleans. The Rose Bowl was already being played in Los Angeles, and there were plans for this. And finally, in 1935, the first Sugar Bowl was played, and it was successful. And one of the things that it was meant to do was to bring people to town and do what people do well, spend money. And, you know, so much of that sort of activity is ways to help separate people from their pocketbooks. And it just grew and grew from that. I think it started the same day as the Orange Bowl. So it and the Orange Bowl share the distinction of being the second oldest bowl game in the United States after the Rose Bowl.
And it was played for many years in Tulane Stadium until we got the Superdome in 75.
You know, one thing that we have chapters on, and I kind of call it, well, fire and ice, I say, because beyond bonfires, we talk about the bonfire tradition outside New Orleans, but also ice and snow. And we have a photo of the 1963 Sugar Bowl at Tulane Stadium with the ground covered in snow. And so they had to have this massive effort to clear the field before they could play that game. But we do talk about the rare times in New Orleans that it did snow, you know, during the Christmas holidays. And for those of us who grew up here, we remember when it snowed.
I remember.
Of course, back to that Katrina year, it was on Christmas Day in 2004 that we had a snowfall. I think it was the only time it ever snowed on Christmas Day in New Orleans. So we could say we had a white Christmas, but you know, certainly what it led up to.
We needed that at that time. That gave us a little boost. Now, being in New Orleans, the end of Christmas is also the start of Carnival.
There's no post-Christmas letdown here, as we know.
No diets either. No New Year's diets.
Not at all. Yes, we have the, of course, wonderful tradition, and going back to our French Catholic roots here, of the kickoff of Carnival on Twelfth Night, January the 6th, and where it's officially okay to eat king cakes. I know some people eat out of season. I certainly don't. But one of the bakeries actually has the Kris Kringle cake, which is sort of disguised as really a king cake. But I think we have to wait until Twelfth Night to have that.
Well, tell us about the king cake, because some people might not have enjoyed that.
Well, the king cakes as we know them, you know, the filled ones and the heavily iced ones really only go back, the past 30 years or so. Prior to that, post-World War II, maybe as far back as the 1930s, most of what people would be used to would be the Mackenzie's king cake. You know, when I came to New Orleans in the early 60s, that was the first king cake I ever tasted, and really the only ones I remember. Prior to that, there were Twelfth Night cakes, and we even found a recipe for a Twelfth Night cake from about 1900 that we wrote up in the book, and it must weigh about 30 pounds. There's so many ingredients in the thing. But Twelfth Night was, even in New Orleans into the early 20th century, was still regarded as the end of Christmas as opposed to the beginning of Mardi Gras, and so the colors were still green and red. Even the first invitation of the Twelfth Night Revelers, which started in 1870, looks more like a Christmas card than it does a Mardi Gras invitation. But it wasn't until we got more and more into the 19-teens, 1920s, that we began to see the evolution of Twelfth Night as the real beginning of the Mardi Gras season, and Christmas sort of being shoved to the background as Mardi Gras became more important. But it was around that time that you began to see more and more of the king cakes as we know them beginning to emerge. Prior to that, it was referred to as a Twelfth Night cake and something that would represent the end of Christmas.
And today, only in the past 20 years or so, the night of Twelfth Night has really become big with the Funny 40 Fellows.
Tell us,
of course,
a little quickly about
on the
that.
Streetcar, who announced that they're the heralds of Carnival. They announced the beginning of Carnival with their streetcar ride on St. Charles Avenue. And I am vaguely familiar with it. Yes, I am. But it's quite a sight. Folks costumed on the streetcar, dancing to the Storyville Stompers up and down the aisles. Great fun. But other activities are now taking place, too. But I have to say, I think the PPP, the Funny 40 Fellows, inspired all that, too.
Well, you revived that. I mean,
yes.
Whoever,
this was an organization
in
the 1800s that was revived in the 1980s. Mm-hmm.
And it's quite a sight, even if you're not a participant, to go and watch the streetcars and
it really is
what's going on. Well, we could just talk about this forever because it's just a charming book.
Thank you.
I love it. It's I bought my own copy besides the station.
Thank you.
And it's everybody who's read it is thrilled with it, and it would make a lovely Christmas present for people mm-hmm. that are listening to this and thinking of what to buy. Our own Susan Larson, the book reviewer for the Times-Picayune, she says, if your heart thrills to the sight of a streetcar decked in holiday greenery and red velvet ribbon, this is the book for you. You've been listening to Writers Forum. We want to thank our guests this week, Peggy Scott Laborde and John McGill, author of just a beautiful, beautiful book, Christmas in New Orleans. I'm Sherry Alexander for WRBH.
Thank you.